From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Rochester on March 23rd, when Rochester police responded to a call on Jefferson Avenue, and you likely know what happened. 41-year-old Daniel Prude was experiencing a mental health crisis. Police ordered Prude, who was naked, to the ground, placed a spit hood over his head, and one officer knelt on his back until Prude suffocated. In a press conference, Rochester Police Police Locust Club President Mike Mazzio said that the officers involved in Prude's arrest were following protocol and conducted themselves consistent with their training, really to the letter. The statement led many people in the community to ask exactly what that training is, and if it's true that police were just following it. And if that's true, is it time to change it? Retired Rochester Police Sergeant Marvin Stefferson addressed that issue during a televised forum on WXXI-TV last month, and we at Connections realized there's still a lot to discuss when it comes to the state of police training. We invited Marv to come back on the program to explore that with us, and we're not going to spend the entire hour on the Prude case, of course, but I think we're going to try to understand how we got here and where we go next. Marvin Stefferson is a retired sergeant with the RPD, an adjunct professor in the Adult Pathway Program at Roberts Wesleyan College. Marv, always nice to have you. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan, thanks. It's always good to be back.
And Jansen Rembert is with us as well, a retired lieutenant with the Rochester Police Department. Jansen, welcome. Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Again, I'll say we're not going to spend the entire hour on the Prude case, but I think that's a big reason that this community is asking so much about how police are trained and whether certain incidents are or are not outside of the training. So let me start by asking both of you, and I'll start with you, Marv. Do you agree with Mike Mazzio that the officers in that video followed protocol, followed training, and that what we saw was exactly as we should expect officers to behave?
You know, from what I'm hearing, they did follow protocol. But again, there's this little thing called discretion that, you know, many of the officers across the country have. So it has to be a measurement of the protocol as well as discretion to fit each scenario. And so I think, you know, Mazzio being a union leader is doing what most union leaders do, and they protect their people, and they figure out how to educate the community after the officers are out of harm's way. But does that always fit what is necessary for the community and the policeman's relationship needs? And I would have to say no.
Jansen Rembert, how did you see that video? How did it hit you? And what do you make of the claims that those officers were following training to the letter?
Well, you know, it pained me very much to see the video itself, what occurred, how it occurred, the tragedy of Mr. Prude's death, the situation that the officers are now in, and with their, you know, and now falling back on protocol and training. That is a very easy thing to say unless you show what that protocol and what that training is. The community has shown in writing, for the most part, what they were told to do and how to do it. It could alleviate some issues. However, you know, I got two words that I believe we have to inject also. It's called common sense. I mean, you cannot take a training or a training tool or training skill past a certain point where now it becomes not training, but dangerous. Positional asphyxiation is highly dangerous. Officers are trained. And once you get to a certain point, you can't say we can't put 200 pounds of pressure on this individual's chest against the cement and they can't breathe. I mean, you have to have common sense when you're executing training, you know, in a situation like that.
So let's talk about how police are trained then, because, you know, when you see, Jansen, when you see an incident like that, what is a specific kind of training that you expect officers to be following in that? Because this hour, I want to touch on how officers are trained for various things. I mean, according to the Police Executive Research Forum, this is from 2016, nationwide police academies spend a median of 58 hours on firearm training. 8 hours on de-escalation or crisis intervention. I mean, we're talking more than seven times as much training on firearms as we do on de-escalation and crisis intervention. And we'll talk in a moment a little bit more about that. But when you see the Daniel Prude video, is that a moment for de-escalation or crisis intervention? Is it something else? What kind of training should be relevant right there, Jansen?
Well, you have to look at the video, obviously, in its entirety. If you're not actually present at the scene, de-escalation. At what point was the situation de-escalated? Mr. Prude is handcuffed. He's in the middle of the road naked. He's not, on a video from what I saw, he's not fighting anybody. He's not kicking anybody. He's not squirming on the ground. Is it de-escalated at that point? If he's just sitting there and talking and rambling, and the officers are 10, 15 feet away in a safe position, there's no need to go hands-on. If he's moving and trying to get away, you may have to restrict his movement. It depends. The escalation will depend on what the individual is doing compared to what the officers are doing and if anybody's in danger. The officers are trained from the very beginning in officer safety. If he's handcuffed sitting on the ground and he's naked and he's not dangerous to the officers or any civilians nearby, and they're keeping traffic from driving by and hitting him in a car, it's fairly well de-escalated. But like I said, they went hands-on. Now the question is, why they go hands-on to the point where they had to restrain him heavily against the pavement? De-escalation is a fine point. If he's not hurting anybody and he's sitting there, is de-escalated.
Okay, and let me ask Marv Stefferson about this too, because that certainly is, Marv, how many people in the public, and I will admit myself included, viewed that video. In other words, when the officer directs Daniel Prude to get on the ground, to lay down, put his hand behind his back, he does all of those things. He does not refuse those directions. And to my eye, that is sort of exactly what you would want. You would want someone who's not resisting. Obviously, he's struggling with potentially a mental health crisis and potentially some drugs in his system, but he's not resisting. He's following the orders. He's nude. He's clearly not armed. He is surrounded by officers. My thought would be that is de-escalated. Now, that doesn't mean it's, you know, that there isn't potentially challenges to come in that interaction, but am I wrong to think, at least at that moment, hey, good job here. We've got this de-escalated. Like, we can work through this. He may say some things that are a little wild or offbeat, and he did, but that's de-escalated. Is that wrong, Marv?
No. I mean, here again, our eyes are not lying to us. But what many a time we've seen through TV and media that depending on who's telling the narrative, they're going to say you're seeing something or you're not seeing something or you don't fully understand what the training is. So therefore, it's not what it seems. The training that we gave when I was still part of the department and part of the training unit was that once the handcuffs are on, the fight is over. Will there be moments of where the person verbally says something or maybe their body moves again, like the lieutenant said before, unless they're up trying to get the handcuffs back around to the front or they're trying to run or if they're inside the car trying to kick their way out of the vehicle, then you have to take other measures to restrict that type of destructive movement, whether it's harmful to themselves or to someone else or to the property of the police property, rather, or someone else's property. But again, it's measured. It is discretion and common sense. It's all these things wrapped up, critical thinking. That's why we hire law enforcement candidates who have exhibited some type of critical thinking, some kind of common sense in their previous occupations or in school, because we interview teachers, parents, neighbors. When we do recruitment, we go deep into the background to get a full picture of who these individuals are that we're hiring. So when you get an officer out on a scene like this, you're hoping for the best outcome because you have what we consider the best person on the street in uniform at that time. And so will life experiences or the lack thereof come into play? Certainly. Will interpretation of movement based upon the lack of communication come into place? Certainly. We've seen that with officers who had deadly force used on individuals who were of the deaf community, right? The deaf community communicates with their hands. So if you're telling these individuals to stop moving their hands or put their hands in a certain place, it can be construed as resistance if those hands are moving any other place than where the officer is directing. But if the officer lacks understanding that they're dealing with someone who's of the deaf community and they need to communicate with their hands, then it's going to be a poor outcome because you're going to have that disconnect of communication. And that's the same thing that we saw with Daniel Prude. When we're talking about mental health, we talk about the body's response to being under the influence of some type of alcohol or a drug. If these officers have not the background or understanding of how people respond and how they react to chemicals or to a mental health crisis, then we're going to have similar outcomes like we had before with the one shooting we had where we shot a person who was deaf.
We're hearing from Marvin Stefferson, a retired sergeant with the Rochester Police Department, and Jansen Rembert, a retired lieutenant with the Rochester Police Department. And I want to address more on this question of how much time officers spend training in different areas. And I mentioned earlier that according to the Police Executive Research Forum from 2016, nationwide police academies spend a median of 58 hours on firearms training, 8 hours on de-escalation and crisis intervention. Now, you could look at that and say, well, that's 7 times plus more training on firearms than de-escalation or crisis intervention. Is that a value judgment? The pushback, and I'll ask our guests about this, is that we shouldn't be comparing firearms training to de-escalation or crisis because one is a mechanical skill and the other is not. If I was hired to build computers, I would spend a heck of a lot more time learning how to, you know, create a circuit board. You can see I'm not an engineer. create a circuit board than I would in dealing with complaints about harassment or hostile workplace. And so I take that point that maybe we shouldn't just compare firearms training to de-escalation or crisis intervention. I will ask our guests if they agree with that, but also to ask if 8 hours is de-escalation or crisis intervention, if that's the median, should it be more or should it be a different kind of training? I'll start with Jansen. How do you see those issues?
Well, basically, I see it as possibly financially driven. When you're talking firearms training, every police department, medium-sized police department, large department, they got a crew of guys or and gals who are firearm instructors who are within the department, and their only job may be firearms instruction. So, and they're now teaching officers to shoot, helping them with their in-service training, get better in their weapons use. They're in-house. They're getting basically paid by the department as police officers doing that particular job skill. When you're talking about the police academy and training for de-escalation, walking into domestic violence situations, neighbor troubles, mental health issues out on the street, now you have to bring in professionals. You have to bring in the people who have the master's degree and doctorates in social work and sociology and psychology. You have to bring in those folks, and that costs money. And a lot of departments are going to skim on that because of the money issue. A lot of departments, medium-sized and small, they can't do 120 hours, 130 hours, 40 hours, whatever it is, in that type of training throughout your department because you're paying somebody $60, $70, $80 an hour to teach. So in the academy, there's a block of training. So now they can say that the state of New York says that there should be a minimum of 8 hours or 16 hours in domestic violence training. And once that department hits that 8 or 16 hour mark, especially in the academy, they're now good to go. So I see the problem being that it needs to be in the year 2021 in the 21st century, we now need to have more training. We're having more contact with folks on the street. People know their rights a little bit more. Matter of fact, in some areas, a lot more. There's going to be more escalation because now individuals are going to basically stand up to the police when they believe that their rights are being violated, you know, on a traffic stop, on a street stop, an officer pulls up and tells a grown man who's waiting for a bus, you can't wait for the bus here, go home. And the individual says, I don't have to go home. I'm waiting for a bus to go downtown. Now, here comes escalation. And now the officer has to realize what he or she can do. And now they're dealing with an individual who knows their rights. So we need to have more training with the social skills of the officers having contact with people on the street and traffic stops. We're having too many incidents across the country where unarmed people are being shot by the police in their car, reaching for their license or going into their glove box. We're getting too many incidents where people are getting physically handled by police officers, 3-4 officers, and they're ending up dead due to asphyxiation or, I hate to say it, straight out strangulation. This is not acceptable. And the people in the country are not, they're basically not having it anymore. And they're standing up to the authorities. And now we're having this escalation of the confrontation between police and citizens. Mm.
Marvin Stefferson, how do you see the question of training? Is it fair to compare hours on firearms to de-escalation or crisis intervention? And is it also possible that de-escalation and crisis intervention, you know, you may get trained on that specifically, but you also may get, you know, elements of that baked into other aspects of training and work that police are doing? I mean, I know this stuff is a little bit more complicated than just looking at total hours, but how do you see the way police are currently trained versus maybe what you would see as more ideal?
You know, it's a complex response because you're talking about how people learn and how they respond. So you're taking someone who may function better looking at written as opposed to oral learning. And now we want to take somebody who goes into the firing range, give them a huge number of hours putting rounds downrange, just trying to practice and get to perfection, or at least as close to as possible, target acquisition and high caliber shots placement. Then you remove them from that room into a room now where they sit down and they have to think how to de-escalate, how to recognize certain types of movements or body gestures or voice inflection and whatnot. And everybody is socially conditioned differently. So you might have someone who excels at firearms, but they have poor communication skills or interpersonal skills. And so you're going to teach them about the things that social workers and sociologists and clinicians maybe go through for their training to de-escalate. And they're going to have a different approach than law enforcement. So do we spend more time teaching someone who may struggle with interpersonal skills? Absolutely. Maybe they need that to bring them up to a functioning level to be able to go out on the street and not get into an escalation every time. But each one is almost like a case-by-case, Evan. So it's hard to put an accurate determining factor that, yeah, if we give them 70 hours of interpersonal training or de-escalation training, that they're going to increase less use of force action on the street. Or if we diminish the time at the range, that's going to decrease the amount of shootings or whatnot that he get into. That's, like you said, that's going to be something that we have to, you know, take data and take experience from other agencies who may put more emphasis on that type of training to see what their outcomes have been, and then measure that and use that as a case by case. But certainly I think that we have to look at utilizing more of our community collaborative efforts who have a background in that area to compensate for that, rather than try to give our officers more tools, which they're not going to be, you know, perfected at. It's like, how do you teach somebody to multitask when we know that multitask is not the most effective approach to things, because no one is good at everything?
Well, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, and we're seeing phone calls and emails already, we're talking about police training. What's the current state of training? What has it been historically? What should our expectations be? And frankly, what does it mean, as Jansen Rembert points out, that you have a growing voice of citizens in this country saying that whatever the training is, the results are not showing the kind of de-escalation too regularly that we're looking for. The too often things get escalated, get heated, lead to a violent confrontation. If you've got thoughts or questions about it, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And let me read from Alex, who sends a note about questions about so-called defunding. He says, your guests are correct that so often this is about dollars. This is about money. And this is why defunding would be a mistake. Police need more funding for more training and better training, not less. More and better training costs money. And Alex is advising us, keep that in mind, because if we want better outcomes and we want, you know, a different kind of training, we have to be willing to spend to do it. Jansen Rembert, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, we have to first of all, we have to make sure that we understand what defunding the police means. I hear it on TV. I see it in the pundits and people talking about it. Defunding the police does not mean, this is my opinion, that we're just gonna, people should just go in, take a chunk of money from the police and leave them to whatever. Defunding basically means let's reevaluate the police funding. If a certain police department is getting $5 billion a year, as one large police department in New York State is, can they operate with $4.5 billion? So now, if that's a yes, that means the city of New York will have, and I just named the city of New York now has $500 million that they could possibly allocate for other use within their city. Drug treatment programs, infrastructure, schools, children, helping homeless, helping veterans, feeding people who need help. I'm sure that those type of things can help that city in the overall picture. And the city of New York Police Department still functions great on $4.5 billion instead of $5 billion. Defunding may mean let's reallocate. People are seeing police departments sending out officers looking like 22nd century space warriors, ninjas, military, with padding from head to toe, 4 foot long batons, and they're going out into situations, and it looks like it's a military confrontation of the police versus citizens. And the people are saying, look, the cops are dressed in this manner, spending all this money, officers pulling up in armored vehicles, look like tanks. That stuff costs money. People are not seeing that as being appropriate. Defunding may mean reallocating. We have to go into the police budget and see what is being spent in what areas. Can more money go into training? Sure, it can go into training. Do the police department want to allocate that training? Does the police department want to increase training in de-escalation, domestic violence, sociological issues? A lot of those departments do not want to do that. They don't want to spend the time to do that. They don't want to take the officers off the street to do that. Until they change that type of attitude, they can get more money, but they're not going to spend it in those areas. They're going to put that money in other areas, doing other things with it, and the money is not going to be used appropriately. I think defunding should be called reallocating the money.
Okay, Sergeant Stefferson.
I think the lieutenant stole my thunder. yeah, definitely. You know, to Alex's point, you always hear folks that have not worked in law enforcement, and I don't know Alex's background, so I don't want to assume. But what I do know is that you know, it's one thing to be supportive of law enforcement, which we need, and I know that the lieutenant can chime in on this as well, to say, you know, when you're working in law enforcement, it's a thankless job. And nowadays, I don't really see that. I see a lot of the supporters are really vocal about supporting the blue. And you got to support people responsibly. Defunding is not, like the lieutenant said, taking a chunk of money away from police departments so then they can't function, right? That's ridiculous to even think that. And when people say that, you know, they shouldn't throw that fear out there that, oh, you're crippling the police departments and they're not going to be able to do their job. Before the departments had this type of equipment, we were doing the job. All right. They didn't have this type of equipment back in the 1920s, the 1900s, 1800s. The police department, I can remember when I was on, like the lieutenant's talking about the SWAT team, you know, I had hockey gear that I used when I didn't have this new high-tech knee pads and elbow pads that they have now. The body, people are very resilient. We find a way to adapt and overcome a situation to get the task done. That was one of our ethos in the Marine Corps, adapt and overcome. And the same thing, the police departments will adapt to their environment and to overcome the barriers to get the work done. By taking those funds and reallocating them to our partners, to places like the lieutenant said, you know, you're going to impact law enforcement if you address mental health or if you address homelessness and hunger and poverty. You're going to impact the people and the segments of the community that would fall under the scope of law enforcement if you put money into that to alleviate some of those issues in there. And so people have to understand that that money being reallocated does help the police. It does not cripple them because it takes less of the work that we would get off our plate because other agencies are now able to do their job because they have more money to do it. And that's my response really to Alex, is that your support is welcome, but it's got to be responsible.
Okay, so we have some emails and phone calls that I think are really going to help frame where this conversation goes in the second half hour, not the least of which is a question about who gets recruited to be police in the first place. What is the mindset and the mentality? Marv had mentioned on a previous program and in our recent televised forum that there are times where officers don't like any criticism, and there is a notion that police need to be warriors. Well, we've got an email addressing that. I'd like our guests to respond to that and much more in the way of phone calls and more as we talk to Marvin Stefferson, a retired sergeant with the Rochester Police Department and a professor in the Adult Pathway Program at Roberts Wesleyan College, and Jansen Rembert, who's a retired lieutenant with the Rochester Police Department. Right back with your feedback for them as we talk police training next. Coming up in our second hour, the final two interviews of candidates who are running on the ballot in this election. We've had many interviews over recent months, a chance for you to hear the candidates at length. Next hour, two separate interviews. One, the surrogate court race. The second, New York State Senate in the 54th District. The candidates next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. First up, I'm going to grab a phone call from Geneva. This is Kevin, listening on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, I presume. Go ahead, Kevin. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. I would contest that we should spare no expenses on de-escalation training, considering the number of lawsuits across the country when you can sit as a result of inadequately trained officers. You add up all that money, that's at taxpayers' expense, the training would be a drop in the bucket.
Okay. Marv Stefferson, what do you think?
You know, when I was in the firearms as well as the defensive tactics unit as a trainer, many a time you had those lawsuits weren't just the community. That was law enforcement families that were suing the departments because the departments didn't make their employees be in shape. They didn't take the necessary steps to stay physically fit to do the job. So when they would go out and go hands-on, they would have a heart attack, or they would eat and have not a great diet and obesity, creating these morbid. So the families would sue the departments because their families succumbed to the mortality of the job itself, not enforcing good diet, good exercise. So when we talk about lawsuits, yeah, the lawsuits are used both not only from the outside, but also from the inside to the police department. You got to take training and utilize it where it's efficient and effective. All right. Not everybody needs to go right to hands on. Matter of fact, use of force in the continuum. Hands on is not the first. All right. It's the officer's presence, being in the position to command performance by their uniform look, by their stance and their presence, their verbal as well as their physical communications before they start to actually go hands on. So understanding police department's tactics, understanding what training really is. Training is a combination of a number of different things. And so we can't throw that fear factor again that, you know, the city's going to go broke with lawsuits because the officers are not getting adequately trained. No, the city is going to go broke from lawsuits where the officers are excessively using things from training because they're using it inappropriately.
Jansen Rembert, same issue here. Can you address, and I'll come back to Kevin in a moment if he wants to follow up here, but can you address that as well? Go ahead.
Well, I agree with your caller. Okay, I agree with him 100%. There should be more training. There should be more money spent in the social issue of the department. The officers have the authority to make arrests. They have the discretion. They have the power. All right. Sometimes it goes past a point it shouldn't have gone past. And proper training will help enhance the officer's ability to realize that. With the different people that they meet on the street on a daily basis, we can't expect everybody to say, well, I'm not going to engage the officer or I'm not going to be confrontational. But the officer, he is tasked with the responsibility of knowing what he or she is supposed to do based on guidelines, based on training, based on, like I said before, common sense. Increased training is fine. Sitting the officers in classrooms, talking to different people in the profession. But when the officer goes on the street, now they have to put that training into use. Now, they do not use the training or deviate from the training, that's where the problems occur. And now the department is trying to defend them, the union's trying to defend them, and people out in the community are saying, wait a minute, that should not have occurred. Now here comes the lawsuits, here comes the settlements, here comes injury to the officers, here come injuries or death to the citizens, and increased training will hopefully stop that type of situation.
Let's ask Kevin if you want to respond to that. Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, no, thank you very much. I appreciate the officers' responses. And, Evan, as always, I appreciate the good that you're doing for our community.
I appreciate the phone call, Kevin, and thank you for listening. Let me get Edward in Rochester next. Go ahead, Edward.
Hi, Evan. My question for the gentleman is, given, well, the background of one of them, at least, in the Marine Corps, I'm sure that he would agree that when one puts themselves into a position where they have to abide by protocols, there is a great deal of structure that restricts one from feeling that they can make choices in the moment. But at the same time, the Navy, which I was a part, it was an expectation that we would have the wherewithal to make those choices. So my question is, do they feel that they are compelled to act the letter of the law in their departments, or do they feel that they are allowed to pursue the spirit of the law?
Okay.
Great question.
Yeah, Marv, you want to start?
Actually, Lieutenant's going to have, a phenomenal response to this, but thank you for your service. I served both in the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard. And what I will say is that the police department is set up paramilitary. And I always thought that was an oxymoron because you're taking only civilians from college and from other places. Very few of us that actually serve in the police department are from the military. And so that philosophy and ideology of the military, where your structure, you follow your directions with very little leeway to function. Again, depending on your role in there, as an infantryman, you didn't have as much flexibility as say maybe someone in the Navy who worked corpsman or was in another MOS. But with the law enforcement, like I mentioned earlier, you have discretion. And they give you that only because not every scenario on the street is going to be cookie cutter the same. And so you need flexibility and leeway to be able to decipher what it is you have, respond to it accordingly, to come to a successful and less than use of force type of resolution. I think that, like the lieutenant said earlier, you got to take common sense, you got to take the discretion, and then your training, and use all that together. And I'll button that up with this. In our SWAT team, what we call ETF, Emergency Task Force, we always had a saying, perfect practice makes perfect. You can practice all the time and it not be done correctly, and you're going to perform incorrectly.
Yeah. I've heard the phrase, practice makes permanent, right? So if you're practicing something that's not a good thing, you're going to make that permanent, and that's not what
you're
going
to do. There you go. Yeah. And so that's where I was going with that, Evan. We always made it a point to say perfect practice makes perfect because we wanted to make sure that what we were doing, what was going to be permanent, was perfect. And so that's the step that you got to really take. And I'm going to stop talking now so Lieutenant can chime in on that.
Lieutenant Remberg, go ahead. Are you there, Jansen? You might be on mute. Let's see.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway.
There you are.
The biggest thing, and have to be very careful about when we're talking or comparing sort of the police department to people in the military, a little bit different protocol for the most part as far as sending people out into the field to take care of the goals and objectives or the mission per se. So we have to be, I'm a little bit cautious about comparing military and police. But the thing is that my basic feeling is the officers have, you know, guidelines, they have rules and regulations, they have policies. And these rules and regulations and policies were put into place over the space of the last 60, 70 years. All the situations have been looked at. The ideal of how to approach these situations have been looked at and analyzed and reevaluated and tweaked here and there. So it's safe to say that we've probably seen in most police departments just about every type of scenario that could occur short of a nuclear explosion or, you know, something crazy like that. So when guidelines are looked at and put in paper, the officers now across the board, whether you have 10 officers in the department or 1,000, they know that in this particular scenario, here are the department guidelines, policies, procedures. That's on the normal scale. When you have something that is more exigent, emergency, life or death, the officer has to make a last-second judgment. The officer is empowered to do certain things, to take certain risks. All of those risks and certain things still have to be within department guidelines, policy, rules and regulations, the laws of the state of New York, the U.S. state constitution, U.S. constitution. It's a very fine line. It's very, very difficult. That's why you want to increase the training. The officers need to think about this ahead of time. Play the scenario in their mind. There were thousands of times, you know, I'm making a traffic stop. I'm getting out of the car with somebody. I'm saying to myself, I'm gonna be prepared to do this if the individual does that. When I stepped out of the car on a traffic stop, I envisioned all of a sudden the door whipping open and the driver jumping out of the car and maybe doing something. I envisioned that. I prepared for that. That's called training. And then, you know, in 31 years, I had to do that a lot of times. But training, you can never have enough training. It's all about the department paying for the training and what type of training the officers are getting. Got to spend the money and the resources in the proper place.
Well, Philip writes to say, with policing, the problem is less the funds available for training and more the type of people hired. Too many ex-soldiers who are trained to fight instead of dealing with people's problems. I'm going to ask our guests if they agree. And, you know, Marv, I was struck by the comments you made on this program, on the WXXI forum, the concern that sometimes police don't like criticism. They can be very sensitive. There's sometimes a warrior mindset. that officers are trained, and there are different types of training out there. Some departments have signed up for training in which officers are basically told you are a warrior when you put on your uniform. Are you concerned that too many police in this country, we're not sort of broad brushing, but do too many police have the mindset that they are warriors on the streets of wherever they are serving? And that are we recruiting people who kind of come in with that mindset instead of, hey, my job is to serve the community, to de-escalate when I can, to serve, to solve problems?
I think that a lot of that is like a collage, if you will, Evan. You have the departments looking for someone who can assimilate to their culture, and the ones that really adjust well are those who come from the military, because, again, the police departments are paramilitary. So the rank structure, the uniform wearing, a lot of the different practices and customs in the military are in the police department. So we recruit warriors from the military. And then you have the informal conversations and socializations that go on within the police department that some people feel, okay, it's a war out there. We're fighting the bad guys. And so it's us against them. And people don't understand the difficulties of our life and the danger that we face every day. Not too many people go to work and not realize that their life could be taken. When we get up, we know every day that we go to work, our life can be taken and we not come back home. That's not something that everybody faces every day. So the reason why I said that we have to get away from that is because, like the lieutenant was just saying, with that visualization training, which we taught a lot of, visualize yourself at the front end, the middle, and the back end of that fight, and you're winning. And so you have all these alpha-type personalities who are told to visualize winning. And so if we tell them that they're constantly in a war, then they're going to have that mindset that I'm a warrior and not a guardian. But if we transition that to what I was saying before, was that you tell them that they're a guardian with the potential that you may have to go into a war type of situation, but you'll survive it. Now the officer stays more into the conscious rather than the subconscious of, I know when to turn on that switch to go to war when I have to, and I know when to turn it back off when I have to be the guardian and protect myself, the others, or even the person that I'm arresting. And so that is part of the training that the lieutenant was kept saying that we got to do more training of. That training has to be more intentional and more specific. Guardian training, training wherein you're incorporating those socialization skills more so than sometimes the hands-on and the weaponry. That is the type of training, that is the type of direction that we need to take our people, because we do have veterans who come in, and they may come in with PTSD, because a lot of these veterans are coming in from combat experience, wherein before you were just serving in the military. A lot of these individuals are now being sent into theater. They're being sent into combat situations, and they bring a lot of that baggage with them into the department, and you're put into another situation that may trigger your PTSD. And so, you know, there's a lot to come in that we had to think about when we talk about recruitment and training and how we take care of our officers and our community.
I'm going to have Jansen respond, but first let me squeeze in perhaps a related phone call. This is from Eric in Rochester. Go ahead, Eric.
Hey, good afternoon. Well, good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for your service, and Evan, thank you for having this discussion.
Sure.
So a little bit quick about my background is I teach leadership and training to the enlisted members of the United States Navy, and I actually just got off my tour of that, doing that for the national level. And one of the questions that kind of come to mind is the police force focusing on, when we talk about training and subject matter expertise, one of the things we realized recently was that we spent a lot of time doing subject matter expertise training, not character-based training, and we found that the more character-based training that we do, it eliminates those ethical failures that typically happen when you're faced with a decision that maybe not be at the point of a gun, but also might be when you have an opportunity to think and act. So my question is law enforcement working on that? Are they going on that at a local level or a national level?
Hang on the line there for a sec, if you could, Eric. Jansen, do you know the answer to that?
Right off the bat, no, I don't. Even though I suspect that it's still subject matter, because we have departments that are 600, 700, 800, 1,000 member deep. It would take time to evaluate, you know, most of their personnel, you know, with character-based training. You know, you can do it in a classroom where you have 25, 30 people sitting there, and you're giving them the curriculum and hoping that it takes hold. If you want to really make sure that that particular individual is getting specialized, individualized training and subsequent evaluation, it's going to take you longer when you have these huge departments. I can imagine New York City trying to do it, or Chicago or L.A. Subject matter, they could just basically put out the information based on that particular subject, give it a certain amount of time, and now they're able to say that those individuals have been, quote unquote, trained, but they haven't been evaluated on how well that training took hold. Now, you know, discussing what we were talking about earlier a few minutes ago about, you know, training yourself in military, I don't want officers going out there with a militaristic mindset. I don't want them hitting the street thinking it's us against them. I don't want them to think that they have to be a warrior when they're stopping a 16-year-old kid on the street because the kid was skateboarding out in the street in traffic or something, instead of mentoring the kid, getting his, you know, getting him to understand the dangers, jumping out of the car, hands on their gun, blading off on the individual, to making it a confrontation when it was a very simple situation. We had a police shooting a couple of weeks ago, week and a half ago, where individuals stopped allegedly for jaywalking, and it turned into a deadly shooting. Those type of things should not happen. Sure, the officers have to exercise officer safety. I would be the first one to tell every officer, exercise officer safety. Go home in the same way you went to work. But that does not mean approaching people 90% of the time, 95% of the time, in a militaristic type of mindset, because that starts the escalation, us versus them. You're going to do what I say, when I say, and if there's any type of resistance, here comes the problem. It's not necessary. Officers have to be safe, but they also have to realize and remember their duties and who they are working for, and to serve and protect. I mean, it's not hard. It just has to be done across the board. And I think we're heading away from it, because there's too many escalations, too many confrontations. The shootings are going up. Officers getting injured and getting killed are going up, and it doesn't have to happen.
Eric, do you want to just briefly follow up? Go ahead.
Yes, sir. So 36,000 sailors is what I was charged with training, so I understand complex numbers. Some of the advantages that we were looking at of getting that character-based training out the door was, you know, involving other departments, bringing them in, having other commands bring their junior enlisted over to us to train. So we're having these conversations about complex things, that character development, that make us make the right decisions at the right time when they matter. We're not just in our own, you know, our own swimming pool per se. So some of the things that we also realized was that if the senior leaders aren't the ones that are out there providing that training and reinforcing those character decisions and traits, it didn't matter how much training we gave the junior folks, if the senior leadership wasn't standing up and saying these are our morals and our values, it didn't matter. So understood. I'm very appreciative of what you guys did, and just, you know, maybe food for thought is something that they can push forward on.
All right, Eric, thank you very much here. Hey, the last question, Marv, I'm going to kick your way. It's come from a number of listeners. Vice President Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, mentioned during a town hall with George Stephanopoulos recently that he wants to see officers trained in more, you know, shoot not to kill, shoot for the legs. And we occasionally see that in Europe and other places, but in the United States, his remarks were kind of lampooned. They were ridiculed a bit. I wonder what you made of those remarks that he made. I mean, is that even a possibility in police training?
I chuckled because, again, it goes back to the lack of understanding, training, and you know, again, Biden, I think, meant well. But, you know, we don't train to shoot to wound. When you're shooting, it's a deadly force situation. You're trained to shoot center mass to the largest part of the body, which is the torso. And so that's the area that you shoot. If you're going to go to wound them, then you use other tools to go to the extremities. But, you know, most places like Europe, you know, you're talking about the UK, there's only a few officers that actually carry firearms. They're more of the bobbies that carry the batons, because it's an edge weapons culture, not like our country, which is a gun culture. So, yeah, that's my response to that.
And you know what? We've got calls stacked up, emails we even get to. We need to keep talking about this, and there's a lot more to discuss in the future. Marv Stefferson, in the meantime, where do we find you on your podcast?
You know, you can go to Spotify, go to Anchor to hear some of the shows. And then if you go to My Tribe Network, powered by Brass Radio 1, you can hear me live on Fridays, as well as the Lieutenant, from noon to 3.
What do you call it?
My Tribe Network. And we call it Too Blue to Be Black, Too Black to Be Blue.
All right. Hey, Marv Stefferson, Jansen Rember, thank you to both of you for your time and expertise this hour.
You're welcome, Evan.
Thank you so much.
Always good to have you. More connections coming up.